The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Going to be starting with articles from the spring 2019 issue, which is titled The 1960s, How Does Change Happen? And we're going to start with the comic that is in here, Murphy and Manio, Tar Heel Time Travelers. This time it's going to be about the sit-in 60s. Wow, that's a really old website, says Murphy. Manio replies, no, that's my Tar Heel Junior Historian Association Club Literary Project, a historical newspaper article about the Greensboro Four. No fair, you got that right. The Greensboro Four were peaceful protesters at a lunch counter that did not serve African Americans. It was a sit-in. They went to the counter, but they didn't get served, so they sat and sat and sat some more. No, Manio, what I meant, no fair, I meant that the Greensboro Four is my literary project. I'm making a historical photo album. No, you meant you're a copycat. No, you are. No, you are. Sometimes I feel just like we go around in circles and back in time with our time travel app. The Greensboro Four were students at what is now North Carolina A&T State University. See, they're allowed to shop in the store, but at the lunch counter, they don't get served. Their names were Ezell Blair Jr., now Jabril Kazan, Franklin McCain, Joseph McNeil, and David Richmond. The next day, the Greensboro Four returned, and five students from Bennett College for Women joined them. They were known as the Bennett Bells. Keeping groups of people apart from others is called segregation, a word that means segregated from the flock. The protest in Greensboro spread to other segregated lunch counters all over North Carolina. There were lunch counter sit-ins in Durham, Fayetteville, and Winston-Salem, in Charlotte, Concord, Elizabeth City, Henderson, High Point, in Raleigh, in Salisbury, in Chapel Hill, in Shelby, and Statesville. Segregation did not stop with African Americans. In Dunn, North Carolina, two American Indian girls sat in at the whites-only public school. Fighting back, school leaders said the protesters could not eat their lunch in the school cafeteria. Segregation had been part of America's history since the beginning. Even though the United States Constitution said in 1788 that the U.S. government could not treat people differently, state governments and businesses like lunch counters could and did. North Carolina allowed segregated white and non-white lunch counters, restaurants, movie theaters, libraries, hospitals, public schools, and swimming pools. But sit-ins started to change that. At lunch counters, the number of people served was dropping. Business was hurting. Managers started to have second thoughts about segregation. Our state had sit-ins before the 1960s, too. In 1957, protesters sat in at an ice cream parlor in Durham with separate seating areas for whites and non-whites. Those protesters were arrested by the police. But the attention protesters got in the 60s made a big difference. In 1964, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, a law that blocked segregation based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. People in the 60s were hungry for change. Speaking of hungry, are you thinking what I'm thinking? Let's get some lunch together. You know, Manio, even though 60s protests blocked segregation, they didn't end what caused it in the first place. I know what you mean. There's still prejudice or prejudging when we make up our minds about others before we get to know them. That's history we can change today, together, starting with our literary projects. I'm thinking my newspaper article could use some pictures, and my pictures could use some captions. Want to work on a group Tar Heel Junior Historian Association project like Murphy and Manio? Ask your advisor for details. Next article is from the editor. It's called What Do You Think? It's written by Kathy East. Do you ever hear adults tell kids things like, you wouldn't understand or you're too young? How does that make you feel? It can be frustrating, but sometimes there's a good reason. You wouldn't want a baby to drive you to school, would you? You would definitely tell that baby you're too young. And even if you're really smart, you might need to study a few more years before you could understand how to do the work of the North Carolina governor or the president of the United States. But students in the 1960s showed the world that young people like you are not too young to change the world. Just recently, I watched a TV reporter interview 10-year-old Yolanda King. She's the granddaughter of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The reporter asked her what she thought about her grandfather's 1963 I Have a Dream speech. It had structure, Yolanda said. His words are powerful, and he said it with power, so you can actually feel it through your soul. Then the reporter asked Yolanda if she wanted to follow in her grandfather's footsteps. Well, some footsteps I do want to follow and keep on the legacy because some of them are important, she said and then smiled. But I want to make my own footsteps. What do you think about what she said? You think her grandfather would be proud? We honor the past when we study history. We can be inspired by people in the past. But each new generation receives a wonderful gift, the freedom to build on our history and create our own future. Like Yolanda, you can make your own footsteps. In what direction will you go? What footsteps will you leave on history? There's a photograph with it, and the caption for that photo is, "What footsteps will you leave on history?" This is a photo of one of the first footsteps taken on the moon, astronaut Buzz Aldrin's boot print from the Apollo 11 mission. He and Neil Armstrong were the first people to walk on the moon on July 20th, 1969. There's also a sidebar, think about it. Read some of the articles in this issue. Look for stories about kids making history, and then think about this. Have you seen or read news stories about students working for change today? How did you learn about them? What are some ideas or issues that are important to you? What are some ways you could become part of those issues or become part of that history? Not everyone has to march or do a sit-in or a protest. What are your special talents? How could you use them to make the world a better place? Next, I'll be reading some articles from the spring 2011 issue of the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, and its title for the issue is Remembering the Civil War. The first article is A Descendant Reflects on the Roanoke Island Freedmen's Colony. If you could cross the creek, you would find safe haven. This article is written by Michelle Lanier, who at the time that this article was published was the acting director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission and the curator of multicultural initiatives for the Division of State Historic Sites and Properties. Even before President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in January 1863, thousands of enslaved African Americans across North Carolina pursued freedom by risking the journey to reach Union Army-occupied areas in the state's northeast. From early 1862 until 1867, former slaves sought safety and community in a thriving freedmen's colony on Roanoke Island. The town of New Bern, where the James City Camp was established in 1863 and continued for decades as an African American community, also became a center for freedmen. Smaller settlements appeared in Beaufort, Carolina City, Washington, and Plymouth. On the banks of the Tar River, Freedom Hill, which became incorporated as Princeville in 1885, was also settled by African American freedom seekers during the close of the Civil War. At the beginning of the Civil War, federal troops considered these escaped slaves to be contraband or property of war. They were later known as freedmen or refugees. They became important sources of wartime labor and even military service. On Roanoke Island, the number of contraband began at about 250 and grew to some 3,500 men, women, and children. The colony became a recruiting ground for the United States Colored Troops, the USCT, as well as a growing village that included churches and schools. Residents faced many challenges during the war years, at times writing petitions and letters of protest in the face of food shortages and other abuse of soldiers' families. With the passage of President Andrew Johnson's Amnesty Proclamation of 1865, the government returned land settled by the freedmen during the Civil War to the former owners. This led to the end of the Roanoke Island Freedmen's Colony. Some freedmen resisted the loss of their war-era homes. While many ultimately left the island, several families stayed, bought land, and reorganized their community. Virginia Simmons Tillett is a descendant of this group and the president of the Roanoke Island Freedmen's Colony Preservation Association. On February 20, 2011, Michelle Lanier interviewed her about this lesser-known Civil War story. Michelle Lanier. Miss Tillett, what was the Roanoke Island's Freedmen's Colony? Virginia Simmons Tillett. In 1862, after Union General Ambrose Burnside was on Roanoke Island fighting, the Freedmen's Colony became a camp or colony set up to help the slaves have a safe haven. If they were able to get to Roanoke Island, then they were given a place to stay and protection. And because there was so many, including my ancestors that came, Reverend Horace James was given the duty of forming a colony like a little village or a little community. And that's exactly what he did. It was flourishing. It had schools, it had churches, and they were able to assist the Union Army in defeating the Confederate soldiers because many of the people who came to Roanoke Island already had skills. They knew the water, they knew the rivers, and they knew the sounds. We were surrounded by water, so our people had to be good boatsmen, good swimmers, knowing the tides and the winds. A lot of our ancestors were fishermen or hunters or trappers. It wasn't cleared off like it is now. There would have been no way for people to escape if they did not know the territory, if they did not know about the tides. A lot of our ancestors could not read or write, but they were very wise. So it began as a very good relationship. Then about a year later, the men were encouraged to join up to fight. They were able to leave their families, they hoped, in good hands. That went along pretty good, and then some things began to fall apart some. There were letters where some of my ancestors, my great-great-grandfather, Henry Ashby, was one of them, signed a petition asking for relief for the family members that had been left behind on Roanoke Island. Michelle, did you grow up hearing about the colony? Virginia, I had heard growing up, and we always knew that the majority of the blacks had just settled on one area of Roanoke Island. We didn't know exactly why. After Dr. Patricia Click, author of Time Full of Trial, The Roanoke Island Freedmen's Colony, 1862 to 1867, started her project, then it all made sense. What we do know is that on what we call the north end of Roanoke Island, some of the families have the same names of the freedmen that were there and fought very hard to stay there. Not only were my ancestors' descendants, but quite a few others that are still around there were. Michelle, when you found out these connections to a pretty extraordinary historical story, what did you think? What did you feel? Virginia, pride, for one thing. Definitely pride to know that my ancestors did have a hand in shaping Roanoke Island. We wonder where we get our grit from to keep fighting, keep fighting, keep fighting. But when you read and research and find out what our ancestors did, that certainly did not have the same educational level that our people have today, but they kept fighting on. Michelle, has there been any effort to organize descendants or commemorate the colony? Virginia, we have the school kids to come out, like a fair where we have crafts from the 1800s, the games, the music, types of food that we ate, and a history lesson. Every year we do a blues jam at Roanoke Island Festival Park, and during about a 30-minute intermission, we give a history lesson on the Freedmen's Colony. Michelle, A lot of the men from the colony were recruited as Union soldiers. Do you have a sense of people in your community or in your community who fought in the Civil War? Is that something that gets talked about or remembered? Virginia. We knew that they fought, but we did not realize that they were fighting because of the Freedmen's Colony. Some may talk about Richard Etheridge as far as him being a Coast Guard man from the all-black Pea Island Life Saving Station, but I'm going to talk about him being one of the soldiers. Captain Etheridge, formerly a sergeant in Company F, 36th Regiment, United States Colored Troops, was one of the men who wrote and signed the letters along with others, including my great-great-grandfather, asking for the family members that were left behind to be treated better. We have a North Carolina aquarium on Roanoke Island, and right on the grounds of that aquarium, Richard Etheridge and his family are buried. That gives us a tangible piece of evidence that that's where the Freedmen's community may have been. Michelle, I've read that 11 African American families bought 200 acres of land after the dissolution of the Freedmen's Colony. Virginia, I live on one of those original tracts of land. They used to call this land California. Don't ask me why, because I've never found anything to explain. But it's where the majority of the black folks live on Roanoke Island even today. Michelle, I understand that after the Amnesty Proclamation of 1865, the government told the freedmen to leave. Virginia, yes, that is a part of the Freedmen's Colony. That is a part of my great-great-grandfather. That's a part of Richard Etheridge. They were writing and fighting for us to be able to stay here on the lands that we thought were ours. Because we had built homes, we had built schools, we had built churches, we had gardens and yards, and then we were asked to leave it, give it back to the owners. A lot of folks left, but my ancestors stayed, and so did some of the others. And that's when men decided to go see Mr. Doe, heirs of Thomas A. Doe, to see if he would sell the land that he sold, and it was divided into pieces. Michelle, with there being churches and schools created in the colony, are there any today that can trace their history back to that time? Virginia, the church that I belong to, Haven Creek Missionary Baptist Church. The name came from the saying that if you could cross the creek, you would find safe haven, and that was at our church. Where it is located now is certainly not where it was in the beginning, because the first church was in the woods. It was just a little lean-to. Yes, our church traces itself back to that period. Michelle, we are now remembering the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. When you think about Roanoke Island and its history, what are some things that you want to make sure people learn? Virginia, the Freedmen's Colony, why former slaves were referred to as contraband, and why they settled not only here on Roanoke Island, but in other areas. You cannot discuss the Civil War if you know nothing about the purpose, what parts black played in it, and what happened to them. As president of the Freedmen's Colony Preservation Association on Roanoke Island, I'm working on a program that will take place in Hatteras in 2012 as part of the sesquicentennial. The association also worked toward attaining a marker about the Freedmen's Colony at Fort Raleigh North National Historic Site as part of the Civil War Trails program. We feel that the history of the freedmen that settled here on Roanoke Island during the Civil War is intertwined with the battles that took place. I wish I knew more. I wish I had asked my elders more questions about all this when I was younger. Michelle, what would you say to young people about talking to older folks? Virginia, take the time to listen to your elders so that you can remember what they said 20 years from today. You can talk to people, but you've got to be able to listen and put that in that memory box. You've got to listen. You've got to ask questions of the older folks in your family. Where did they come from? What was my granddad like? What did he do? There's a map accompanying the article, and the caption says, "This Civil War era map shows Roanoke Island, the location of a large freedmen's colony. In August 2011, the graveyard of the Atlantic Museum will dedicate a monument to the African-American Civil War story on the Outer Banks. The Hotel de Afrique on Hatteras Island, for example, served as a forerunner of freedmen's colonies." Next article is Measures Not at All Pleasant, Hard Times on the Home Front. This was written by A. Christopher Meekins, who at the time was the correspondence archivist at the North Carolina State Archives and chairs the Symposium Subcommittee for the Office of Archives and History's Civil War Sesquicentennial Committee. He holds a Master's of Arts in History from NC State University and has written on dissent in Civil War era North Carolina. Here's an excerpt of a letter from Mary C. Moore, a soldier's wife, writing to North Carolina Governor Zebulon Vance on March 21, 1863. Having from absolute necessity been forced into measures not at all pleasant to obtain something to eat by the cruel and unfeeling speculators who have been gathering up at enormous prices not only breadstuffs but everything, even down to eggs, chickens, and vegetables, to carry out of our own state for the purpose of speculating upon them, we feel it is our duty, honored and esteemed governor, to inform you truthfully of our proceedings. And Ezra Bullock, a soldier, also writing to Vance on March 26, 1863, the families are nothing but men, women, and children. If they had the corn planted, they could tend it. Most of them are poor people, and provided if it was planted, they might make support for the year coming, for we do not know how long the war will last, and if it lasts another year, some of us are bound to perish. In April 1861, United States President Abraham Lincoln called for troops to suppress a growing rebellion in the southern states. Like most leaders in the North and South, Lincoln believed that any real fighting would end quickly. There would likely be one or two large battles, they thought. If the United States or Union forces won, the rebellion would end. If the Confederate States of America won, they would become a separate nation. On May 20, 1861, North Carolina joined the group of 11 Confederate states that seceded or withdrew from the United States. In the rush to field an army, each side allowed soldiers to enlist or join for 1 month or 3 months, thinking that the fighting would cease before those terms of service ran out. The first major battle, fought in July 1861 at the small town of Manassas, Virginia, near a creek named Bull Run, ended with a Confederate military victory. President Lincoln, however, said he would continue to fight to preserve the United States as a whole. He refused to acknowledge the legitimacy of the Confederate government. What most people at first thought would be a brief confrontation became a lengthy struggle. It would last 4 bloody years. Neither side was prepared for this extended fight. A prolonged war meant soldiers had to remain in the army longer than planned. It also meant that goods, like food and clothes, would be in short supply for both military forces and people at home. United States forces blockaded Confederate seaports. They tried to keep ships from taking materials out and tried to prevent goods from other countries from reaching the Confederacy. At first, the blockade did not work very well. However, the longer the fighting continued, the more effective the tactic became. By spring 1863, many basic goods, such as coffee, sugar, and flour, proved very difficult to buy in the South. Salt, badly needed for food preparation and preservation in the days before electricity, became extremely scarce. North Carolina built salt works along the coast to harvest salt from seawater, and desperate farm women scraped smokehouse floors to recover what salt they could. The demand for such scarce items drove up prices. The high prices attracted people who would invest in buying the goods and then sell them at even higher prices to make as much money as possible. Citizens of North Carolina grew to dislike speculators, as these people were called. Keeping soldiers in the army longer than expected led to another home front problem. When it came time to plant crops in 1863, men serving in the military were not available to help with the farm work. Tar Heels became discontented over both of these issues. Many sent letters appealing to Governor Zebulon Vance. Some even took matters into their own hands. Speculators drove up the cost of supplies in Salisbury until local women acted against them. 40 or 50 women remembered in primary sources only as soldiers' wives gathered in town. They began going from business to business, demanding that shopkeepers sell them goods at a fair price. North Carolina's government had set the price of a barrel of flour at $19.50, but merchants had been going against the regulation of such price controls to sell flour for as much as $50 a barrel. At first, the Salisbury merchants refused to cooperate. The woman threatened to take the goods without paying at all. Confronted by such hostility, the shopkeepers one by one agreed to the citizen's demands. After losing 10 barrels of flour to the group, merchant Michael Brown immediately wrote to the governor to complain and ask for help. Mary Moore, a Salisbury woman, also wrote to Governor Vance. She detailed the hardships that women in the state faced and described the greed of the speculators. In December 1863, the General Assembly of North Carolina passed a measure to provide relief for the wives and families of soldiers serving in the Confederate Army. The law granted money that county officials could use to purchase goods for the benefit and the use of these families. This aid eased the problem of shortages enough to end the riotous actions of the Salisbury woman. Of course, the law helped families all over North Carolina. Most Tar Heels depended on agriculture to survive. Some soldiers received letters from their families asking them to return from the battlefront and plant a new crop. Soldiers like Ezra Bullock of Edgecombe County then wrote to Governor Vance, begging for leaves of absence so they could go work and save their families from going hungry. Women such as Mary Owens petitioned the governor for the release of sons or husbands so they could work on farms. The military needed soldiers, though, and could not afford to let them leave. Men were torn between the needs of the Confederacy and the needs of their families. Some deserted the army long enough to slip home and plant crops before returning to battlefields. Vance assisted these men by offering a general reprieve from punishment if any soldier who had gone home for such a purpose would come back to the army. The unexpected length of the war created hardships on the home front that affected everyone. By 1865, food became so scarce that soldiers in the Confederate Army, as well as their families at home, faced starvation. In the end, the Confederacy collapsed as much for the lack of food and other supplies as for defeat in battle. Details of these hard times and unpleasant measures are preserved in the records of the North Carolina State Archives in Raleigh. This article used letters to the governor and some newspaper materials. The State Archive stores many more records of the era that the public can research. Documents and other primary sources help modern Tar Heels remember the Civil War. There's a photograph of a letter in the article's, the photograph's caption says, "As the Civil War raged on, life became increasingly difficult for ordinary citizens. Ezra Bullock of Edgecombe County was one of many soldiers who wrote to Governor Zebulon Vance about his family's hardships. Vance, a Buncombe County native elected in 1862 and again in 1864, clashed often with Confederate President Jefferson Davis over states' rights and individual liberties, struggling to meet the needs of both North Carolinians and the Confederate government." We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.